You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Doug Nolan. He is the portfolio manager for the Tactical Short Strategy at McIlvany Wealth Management, and Doug was previously involved as portfolio manager at the Federated Equity Management Company, where he was in charge of the Prudent Bear Fund and the Prudent Global Income Fund. That was from 1999 to 2008. And prior to that, he also worked for short biased hedge funds from 1990 to 1998. He writes an excellent market summary every weekend. It's available, I believe, in it's a summary and an analysis of the events of the past week, and sort of keeps people up to date with where the markets are and where he believes the markets are headed. And it's really, I think, very important if you're a serious investor. You want to check this out. You need to go to creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. creditbubblebulletin.blogspot.com. It's free of charge. I went there and looked at a couple of the last issues over the last weeks in preparation for our discussion with Doug today. Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Jay. Really nice to be back with you. And thanks for, you know, I'm feeling old when you talk about my, you know, my history. I forget how old I'm getting. So.
Well, we're in the same boat, Doug. And I can remember the days when you worked with David Tice back at the Prudent Bear Fund. And that was a couple of decades ago or so, right? So, yeah, time does pass quickly, that's for sure. And the older you get, the faster it goes. So, and now things really seem to be speeding out of control almost. And I've titled today's show, Why the Risk of Hyperinflation May Be Real. And I sort of picked that up from a recent, I think maybe it was a May 21st Credit Weekly Bulletin. You wrote, and I quote, rather than subprime mortgages as the system's weak link, today it's subprime corporate credit. History suggests today's festering issue in credit derivatives and structural finance will prove woefully worse than anyone today appreciates, and there is little policymakers can do to remedy the situation. The cycle has changed. The amount of stimulus necessary one more time to resuscitate bubble dynamics would risk hyperinflation. End of quote. So, I guess I'd like to start out by asking you, what about the corporate credit? How has it changed? And paint us a picture of corporate credit and why you're concerned about it.
Sure, Jay. I'll go all the way back to the early 90s. Try to do this quickly. So we had an impaired banking system. And back then, it was the banking system through lending that drove credit growth. Well, the banking system was impaired. And that's when Alan Greenspan started to accommodate the expansion of market-based credit, asset-backed securities, corporate debt, MBS, derivatives, all of that, that took on a life of its own. So my concern right now is we have so much marketable debt out there, especially high-yield debt, corporate debt, and this is very problematic in that you can have a run on ETFs and different holders that own this debt, and it's very different than the old cycles where it was the banks that were sitting on these problem loans. Now they're in these different instruments in the market where people can liquidate and even panic out of them. So it creates a very unstable backdrop. We saw this in March of 2020 with the pandemic, how quickly things can unwind. We certainly saw it back in 2008. And my concern today is previous crisis episodes, central banks could slash interest rates, do QE. If they needed to, they would do trillions of QE, as we saw in the pandemic response. That type of response today is very problematic because of today's inflation. So that's why this is a bit of a unique environment here.
Yeah. So that's why the stimulus required this time. I'm wondering if some of these credit instruments, high yield debt and so forth, if there might not be a liquidity problem with some of these things. I mean, if everybody tries to get out the door at the same time, is that a concern?
Sure, and think of it this way, where we've had these bubbles, and that's been, my analytical focus now for 30 years. So we've had these various bubbles, and when one bubble bursts, then the Fed has created a new bigger bubble, and that's the way these things work. We had the tech bubble, then the mortgage finance bubble, and then what I call the global government finance bubble that unfolded after the 2008 crisis. The bigger these bubbles are, when they burst or when they're bursting, you need a huge response to kind of resuscitate the bubble. And that's what we saw with the pandemic, where it was $5 trillion in 2 years.
Oh.
So these types of measures only make the bubble bigger and lead to the next rescue has to be bigger. And that's why I'm saying today, in a bubble bursting environment, it would take massive QE. But that QE today is much more, would drive consumer prices much more than they have in the past because of these, strong inflationary forces we see throughout the economy.
Are you The inflationary forces are, do you see them mostly? I guess it's a combination of both the supply side and the demand side. We're seeing the restrictions, of course, because in the past decades we've seen the global economy growing. We've seen more globalization. Now we're seeing a restriction of it for various geopolitical reasons or what have you. Where do you see both sides of it then as problematic, I suppose? It's the stimulus, the money that's pumped into the system. That we've seen pumped into the system the last number of, well, especially since COVID, and now the war in the Ukraine and various other issues, geopolitical issues. China doesn't seem to be all that interested in exporting things. They seem to shut down Beijing with they have a couple of COVID incidents. And what do you make of it? This seems to be a lot different in a lot of ways, in addition to what you just talked about from my perspective.
Sure, Jane. The way I look at it from my analytical framework, we're transitioning into a new cycle. We've had this previous cycle that's gone on for a few decades. That cycle was an experiment in monetary policy, economic structure. It was a huge experiment in finance with all these new instruments. That cycle, you had financial assets performed extremely well. And there was a huge bias. As long as they performed well, all the finance would flow into financial assets. It led to market bubbles, asset inflation, all of that. But it also helped contain inflation somewhat because it pulled in all the excess liquidity. Now I'm seeing the cycle has turned. Globalization has turned down. That was part of the last cycle. We're seeing supply constraints, right? We're seeing changes in psychology by workers, by corporations. People now want to be paid more, they want to charge more. There's more bias to own hard assets, right? So there's demand for a lot of things globally, not to mention right now the war in Ukraine, grain shortages, potential food crisis, the end of just-in-time inventory. There's all types of dynamics now that have started in this new cycle, and I think the new cycle favors hard assets over financial assets, which creates, and this gets a little complicated, I'm sorry, but it creates a different dynamic where if the Fed adds liquidity, it's not just going to go into financial assets like it has in the past. Now it's going to go into real things and only make the inflation issue more acute.
Well, what to what extent do you think that Mr. Putin's recent activity or actions of requiring payments in rubles for natural gas might be playing a role in this, causing people to think in terms of, well, money isn't just something that's created out of, keystrokes of a computer, but in fact, it needs to have something behind it. And we also see, historically, we see financial asset prices so high compared to where they've been historically relative to these kinds of commodities that you have to stay alive.
Sure, and I'm going to lean on the bubble analytical framework a little bit more here. when the bubble is expanding, when credit is expanding, when the economies are expanding, asset prices are expanding, this is a dynamic where, you know, you get a lot of cooperation, integration globally. The view is the pie is getting bigger. So if we work together, we can all do better. Mm-hmm. Well, at the end of the cycle, that starts to fray. You start to see friction, tension in these relationships. When the cycle turns, then you see disintegration, a breakdown of relationships and conflict. I think that's where we are in the cycle now. We're seeing that with Putin. We're seeing that with China. These old relationships are breaking down. The whole dollar reserve system is changing now. It's going to be a system for, you know, half the world, and then the other half of the world will go with China and Russia and their own system. So I definitely think this type of an arrangement is, you know, pro hard assets. You know, Russia right now, their currency has been relatively strong because the perception is they have crude and oil and resources to back their currency, I guess. And there's going to be problems for currencies that are continue to be unstable. And it's just just completely different dynamics than we've been witnessing for quite some time that are unfolding now.
To what extent do you think the market, the generally, investors in stocks, I get the sense that most people sort of think that the Fed will always be there. It's been there, you know, we go back, you and I, several decades. And every time, you know, we think the wheels are going to come off of everything, they find a way to keep it going. And, you know, starting with Greenspan put, every Federal Reserve chairman since then seems to have had a Greenspan put or their own put. And so, they'll always come to the rescue. Don't you think that mentality is still with us to a great extent? People still believe that the Fed can deliver once more?
Absolutely. Yeah. The view is the Fed put is alive and well. It may be a little bit lower strike price, a little lower on the market. Yeah. But we've witnessed this, right? It started with Greenspan tinkering with interest rates to get the markets to do what he wanted. And after a while, that wore off. So it's aggressive rates slashing and then bailouts. And then they start QE in 2008 with $1 trillion and then do another $2.5 trillion. And then we get to 2020 and they unleash $5 trillion. The problem today is, as I mentioned, these bailouts have to be bigger, but the problem is central banks now have to focus on consumer price inflation for the first time in decades. And it's a serious concern. It's a concern for them. They see the hardship for the American people. They see the pressure from politicians. So it's a different dynamic now. It's different. They just can't print trillions without pretty obvious consequences. So I think the stock market, they're not as attuned to the Fed's dilemma as I think they probably should be. I think the Fed put comes later than usual, and importantly, it comes in a lot smaller size. If you remember back to March of 2020, they start with these QE announcements. I think it was like $500 billion. Well, that didn't work. The markets continue to unravel. Okay, another $500 billion. And, they just kept ratcheting it up until they reversed the markets. I think it's going to be very difficult for them to come out and say, okay, $2 trillion. And people are going to say, wait a minute. We have 8.5% CPI inflation. What is the bond market going to say about this if the Fed starts aggressively printing more money when inflation is already this elevated? And I think at the end of the somewhere, the bond market, the so-called bond vigilantes are going to come out and say, wait a minute, enough of the QE here, enough of the QE, especially if it just gravitates into higher consumer prices. So I think they're really, they've stretched it. They overexpanded aggressively in 2020, and now they'll pay the price by not having a lot of tools in their toolkit to deal with the problems that are unfolding.
Do you think the bond vigilantes have started to stir or wake up a little bit?
uh, Maybe a little bit, but you know, the 10-year yield at 2.85 is not really the type of response I would expect from bond vigilantes in this type of an environment. I think the bonds get really nervous if they start to hear the Fed talking about big QE programs. In a crisis environment, if the Fed starts releasing these, you know, having these press releases talking about big QE, I think at that point, I think the bond market protests. The bond market, Jay, it reminds me a little bit of back 2007 to early 2008, where even in 2008, we had, you know, the oil price spike and we had, you know, significant consumer price inflation. But the bond markets weren't that concerned because the bond market sensed these fragile bubbles, mortgage finance and different things, right? So, you know, the bond market anticipated aggressive monetary ease, and that's one of the reasons yields didn't go up. I think there's a little bit of that going on now with bond yields are so low because of the bubbles in the U.S., the bubbles in China and globally. You know, the bond market senses that inflation is not going to be an ongoing problem because these bubbles were burst. But I think the policy responses to bursting bubbles will definitely concern the bond market.
So I would imagine, you know, the Fed really wants to have a soft landing. They want to bring us down to some stability level. Inflation's down, and we can go back to very low interest rates, and as if that would cause the economy to grow. I mean, I think there's other issues, but I mean, the chances are not very good historically of the Fed being able to orchestrate a soft landing. They're going to try, I guess. I guess they're trying. They're doing a lot of jawboning. It's a lot of talking, probably trying to get the psychology changing. I don't know. How do you think they're going to approach? How are they approaching this right now? And do you think they're going to err on the side of too much restriction, and then all of a sudden things swirl out of control, go down the drain, and then they have to go back to some massive QE program? Is that how you see it, or what do you think the best bet is?
Well, right now, I think it's a lot of inflation bark and no bite. There's a lot of talk, and they think with this talk, it's, you know, it's similar to the Greenspan tinkering, where a lot of talk, it'll bring you know, the stock market down and things will cool off, bring home prices down and things will cool off. I just think this inflation is going to prove resilient and very difficult to control. Again, a new cycle. So I think they're going to have a real dilemma because they don't want to slam on the brakes, right? They don't want to because they know the markets, you know, the markets will not take that well. There will be bursting bubbles everywhere. So they want to kind of gingerly bring this thing down, the so-called soft landing. I don't think that cuts it as far as fighting inflation. I don't think it cuts it. Right now, inflation is so strong and it's global that if they want to bring it down, they're going to have to get very close to slamming on the brakes. They're gonna, you know, and I don't think they want to do that. So my guess is inflation is persistent, and at some point again, I think the bond market's going to force them to be more aggressive with their not only with their rate increases, but with their QT, reducing the balance sheet. And none of this, I think, goes over well with risk markets. So it's a real dilemma they have.
What are the chances that one man, Chairman Powell, could do what Volcker did in 1980? And it's sort of funny because I think almost everybody discounts that possibility. I remember talking to Ron Paul about this decades ago, and Mark Faber at a dinner in San Francisco, and both of them just sort of laughed at the notion then already. And things are far, far more worse, far, far worse now than they were back at that time. And yet, I hear Danielle DiMartino Booth the other day in an interview that she did, suggesting that Chairman Powell orchestrated his renomination as Fed chairman exactly so he could be that tough guy that would actually bring things back in line with the tough medicine that's required. To me, that just seems awfully far-fetched. But what are your thoughts?
I've been trying to cut Powell slack all along because he was put into a situation, you know, the bubbles have been going on for such a long time, and I kind of assumed they would burst on his watch and he would get blamed. So I've tried to cut him some slack. He's done everything to make me almost regret doing that with pandemic QE. I think Powell, he would like to be a Volcker. He would like to be principled. He would like to be aggressive and do the right thing. But this financial structure does not allow him to do that, because markets will crash. They will crash if he raised rates like Volcker did. Again, we have a system dominated by market-based finance. It's not the old bank finance of the Volcker era. This is derivatives, hedge funds, ETFs, all of the Wall Street structured finance. I often say contemporary finance, it's almost miraculous as long as it's expanding, as long as credit is expanding, asset prices are inflating, the hedge funds and everyone's putting on more risk and leverage, it works great. This system does not work in reverse, because quickly you have illiquidity, you have dislocation and panic. So I think Powell, he's just going to he'll be the cautious tightener, because he's not going to have any choice.
Yeah, and it probably will be too little too late, if I read your thought process.
And Jay, we've had 15 months of inflation above the Fed's target. Right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And rates today, Fed funds are 75 basis points to 1%. Mm-hmm. I mean, rates today should be at 4 or 5. But anyway, they're so late. And the fact they were late just prolonged the manias that we've seen in risk assets and crypto and stocks and everything else, and just made a bad situation much worse.
Okay, with just a couple of minutes left, you mentioned it should be 4 or 5%. I just heard an analyst say on the internet, I can't recall who he was now, but somebody that's well known, and he was saying he agrees it should be at 4 or 5%. But he says if we went to 4 or 5% right now, that is, if the government's overall borrowing cost was 4 or 5%, it would take a while to get there, presumably. But if we got to that level, then the debt service, the interest that would be payable, that would be paid by the government, would be 30%, which is equal to the military budget. And it's also equal to the, I think he said, the Social Security budget. So there's 90%. And he said that that would start to shake the market's confidence in the Treasury. And his view is that the Fed, one of the considerations is keeping the Treasury credibility out there so that the government can continue to borrow. Any thoughts on that?
I cannot disagree. And it's one more reason why, the Fed is in a dilemma and they're not going to be able to tighten the way they need to tighten to rein in inflation. It's the market bubbles. It's the Treasury's bubble of debt issuance. They've accommodated loose finance for way, way too long. And this is what we're left with, is a situation very difficult to control.
All right, with 30 seconds, then, what do you think? I mean, is there anything, where should people be putting their money? Where is your fund, a tactical fund, putting, how are they allocating their capital? A lot of shorts.
Yeah, tactical short. We're just short. We're a hedging vehicle for people to hedge.
Okay.
I'm a hard asset guy. Mm-hmm. For my family. I'm also the strategist at McIlvany Wealth Management on the long side, our MAP strategies. We love hard, hard assets, precious metals in particular. Mm-hmm. I also like cash today. Mm-hmm. And the best thing we can do, I think, is save as much money as we can right now, rein in our spending, and get ready for difficult times, unfortunately.
Yeah, good advice. Thank you so much, Doug, for coming on with us and giving us your insights. They're very much appreciated. We'll have to leave it go at that now, and talk to you again sometime soon, I hope.
Thanks so much, Jay. Nice to be with you.
All right, folks, we do have to go now. Next week, Eric Coffin will be with me, as well as Dr. Quentin Henning, to talk about Irving Resources, and Michael Oliver will return as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Business Channel.